For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. A few weeks ago, I started talking about the heritage of early Japanese Buddhism before the founder of our Soto Zen practice, Dogen, in Japan. And I want to continue tonight talking about this background of our practice. So yesterday we did our annual Sagaki ceremony for feeding the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghost being one of the six paths or six destinies in Buddhist cosmology. And I wanted to talk about these six destinies as a new paradigm for understanding reality in medieval Japanese Buddhism, a little before Dogen. So I'm talking from this book from a fine American Buddhist scholar, William LaFleur, who's now passed, but he talks about how this transmigration between these six destinies became a way of understanding reality in medieval Japanese Buddhism before Dogen, actually going back to the Nara period in the 700s. And Dogen lived 1200 to 1253. I talk about Dogen a lot. He's important in our practice. But these ideas, which, came from India and China, but really took on independent meaning in Japan, are still important in our practice. So I'll start with a poem by early Japanese poet, Otomo Tabito, from the very early collection Manyoshu. Getting my pleasures this way in my present life may make me turn into an insect or a bird in the life to come. This poem is included in a section of 13 of his poems celebrating the pleasures of drinking. Getting my pleasures this way in my present life may make me turn into an insect or a bird in the life to come. So this was an understanding of transmigration. So there's six, in Buddhist cosmology, there's six realms in which we can pass from lifetime to lifetime, this is understood in various ways. So these are the gods, heavenly beings, and this fits into the Japanese idea of kami, or Japanese spirits that are venerated in Japanese Shinto, humans, asuras, or powerful fighting titans, sometimes they're called, animals, hungry ghosts, who we talked about yesterday, these insatiable beings who we tried to, well, we did appease yesterday. We called them forth in this room and fed them with dharanis or spells and often many food offerings on the altar. And then hell creatures who are very miserable. Now, these different realms are not eternal realms. So hell is not eternal like eternal damnation in the West. Heaven is not eternal. One can pass from one to the other. So the point that William LaFleur emphasizes is that this way of thinking became a new way of understanding and making sense of reality in medieval Japanese Buddhism. And he attributes this to a fellow named Kyokai, who was a monk, not an especially learned monk, but a monk who collected folk tales. So there's a very rich heritage of folk stories in Japan and in China, actually, and in many cultures. But he put these together in a text, the new Nihon Ryoiki in Japanese, but it's basically miraculous tales. LaFleur says this is a watershed work in arguing, as it does, for the Buddhist idea of karma and transmigration. It reflects a time when these ideas were still novel, unacceptable, or unintelligible to large portions of the populace in Japan. So a little later on, even in like the tale of Genji in the Heian period, this was accepted. But this was in the 700s or early 800s that Kyokai was talking about this. It was new for Japan. And it provided a way of thinking. So Kyokai talks about himself in the introduction to this work. Here at the temple called Yakushiji in Nara, I, Kyokai, am a monk. I see human society very clearly and notice able people who are doing evil things. Some have a greed and eagerness for profit that is mightier than the magnet that pulls iron out of the mountain. So Yakushiji is an interesting temple in Nara. I have visited it. It means the medicine temple. I think it's from the Yogacara school, technically. Anyway, he says a little further, good or evil deeds make their own reward or retribution. The way a shape in the sunlight makes its own shadow. Pain and pleasure are produced by such actions in the same way that a sound in the valley produces its own echo. Those who see and hear such things immediately think of them as marvels, but forget that they are real events in our own world. He also says, I cannot, having with my own eyes seen such things happen right here, I cannot be indolent and indifferent. I have spent a good deal of time sitting and thinking about this, but now it is time for me to break my silence. So he wrote this text, which is basically just a collection of these strange stories, miraculous stories. LaFleur says they are just anomalous stories. He contrasts Kyokai with one of his contemporaries, the great Kukai, or Kobo Daishi, the founder of Shingon, who was a brilliant scholar and is highly venerated in Japan as the founder of the Shingon school, the Japanese Vajrayana or esoteric or tantric school. Dave Dirksen, who's on our board, recently came back from a trip to Mount Koya, which is the center of one of the centers of Shingon. It's a mountain high up. You have to take a cable car to get there. It's in the old days, it was a long hike. It's a beautiful, still a beautiful place. But he was also a very sophisticated, highly literary prose writer and verse writer. But his writing wasn't particularly read or important. It didn't make that great an impact in Japan. It's now, we can read it now, and it's wonderful Buddhist and spiritual literature, but he was more celebrated as a founder. In fact, there's a mausoleum there up on Koyasan on Mount Koya where he is still said to be sitting. I mean, he died in 835, but his body is said to be sitting in meditation there still. But at any rate, what LaFleur is saying is that this fellow Kyokai made a much greater impact. He established a new way of seeing the world, of seeing reality in Japan. And so that's what I want to talk about today and how that impacts even our practice now, even though it's not how we think about reality. But it impacts the background for our practice, including the chant we just did, and So just to read what LeFleur says about this, Kyokai's paradigm has its problems, but this work he wrote became a fascinating document if we think of its author as a man excited by the prospect of offering his contemporaries on every stratum of society a new way of explaining the world and its experiences. Kyokai's basic strategy as a writer was to begin with accounts of strange, bizarre, believe it or not, events. He tried to be precise in telling their geographical and temporal locations, and his accounts have an unusual amount of detail that enhances their verisimilitude. So these stories, which, you know, are very strange, he often gives a name, or he tells the exact place or the time when these stories happened. It is true that both these miracles refer to highly unusual and atypical events. There is an important difference between them, however. In the religious and intellectual history of the West, miracles have usually been understood as suspensions of the laws of nature, or the eruptions of divine will into the normal patterns of the cosmos. Traditional understanding has been that such interruptions revealed the existence of a concerned deity. So a miracle in the West is something that happens that's not part of our rational world. It's an intervention of the deity, who as a creator of the cosmos has the capacity to suspend its laws at will. The complete cosmology of medieval Europe thus included not only the world and its laws, but also the creator who, having made the world, now providentially sustained it through law and occasionally intervened in the world and its laws through miracle. By contrast, the cosmos in Kyokai's view has neither a functional role for a creator deity nor any real suspension of basic law, that is, the law of karma and transmigration. This does not mean that suspensions of karma were not present within Buddhist thinking, but merely that they were not conceptually important for Kyokai. So what Kyokai introduced was a way of thinking about these anomalous events as part of the laws of transmigration. So LeFleur proceeds to offer to in this new way of explaining. He tells examples from six stories from that come from this text, of what we would call miracle stories, or he would call anomalous stories. And I'm not going to read the text, but I'll just paraphrase and give descriptions of them. One of them is a story about a melon merchant who would pack melons on a horse to such an extent that the horse was overburdened and really weighed down with this huge burden, far in excess of what the horse should carry. And he would beat the horse and force it to take the melons to market, after which he would kill the horse. And he did this over and over again, and the story goes that one time he was looking down into a kettle of boiling water and his eyes fell out, the merchant. So this showed the karmic retribution for what he did to the horses. So this was just, and this was understood as a part of the law of karma. And the remark is made that after all, these animals might have been his parents or our parents in a past life. So this was a reasonable result of his actions. Part of the point of this way of seeing the world, of transmigrating through these different realms, is that there is individual responsibility. What happens is your responsibility. You can become an animal. You can move from animal to, if for animals who are very good, they can become humans. You can move from being a human in a good situation to a bad situation, all because of your individual responsibility. So this was a way of understanding reality and society and the world around them that made sense in a certain way, that was a basis for seeing a reasonableness of the world for medieval Japan. So that the story of that merchant is the story of karmic falling. And there's another story. These stories are very strange in lots of ways. But this another story tells of a man who made a vow to build a pagoda in honor of the Buddha. Pagoda is the East Asian version of a reliquary where a Buddha's relics are. But he failed to actually fulfill his vow and build a pagoda. When he was 70 and his wife was 62, somehow they gave birth to a girl who was healthy and fine, except that her left hand was in a fist, and they couldn't open it. When she was 7 years old, suddenly it opened, and they saw two particles which they recognized. It doesn't say how they recognized, but they recognized these as relics of the Buddha, as particles of the original Buddha. So they built a pagoda for it and enshrined these particles of the Buddha in the pagoda, after which the girl immediately died. And which was okay, because she died having fulfilled this deed of the Buddha. So this is considered a positive. You know, the girl and the parents both fulfilled this vow. Anyway, there are a variety of these strange stories of events that can be explained, strange events, anomalous events that can be explained by this law, these laws of transmigration. He also talks about particularly powerful beings, great beings. So he one of the things that this way of seeing, this way of explaining, this new paradigm does is that it integrates Buddhism with native Japanese, we say Shinto, but Japanese lore, or actually the other way around, it integrates Shinto ways of seeing things into Buddhist context. He mentions, for example, Gyogi Bodhisattva, who was an historical monk from the Nara period who did great works, but also was said to have the heavenly eye and could see people's past lives and see people's karmic doings. And also another historical, semi-historical person, Enno Gyoja, who was pre-Buddhist but a great native ascetic sage who lived in the mountains and is a great Shinto or pre-Buddhist Japanese hero. And LeFleur talks about how this shows the shamanic side of this worldview. This is the Buddhist fusion with a primitive shamanism and divination, the creative impulse which was elicited in the Heian period, that's like from 800 to 1200, as well as in the subsequent history of Japanese religion. By presenting Gyogi Bodhisattva as it does, this work reinterprets the unusual capacities of a shaman such as Gyogi as having all along been in the possession of the heavenly eye. The shamans and seers of archaic religion are thus revalorized as exceptional beings able to see the whole six realm system and the procession of individuals through it. Even archaic shamans are thus interpreted as having been seers not only of individual fates and fortunes, but of an entire system understood to be basically Buddhist. So it's including this early Japanese way of seeing into a Buddhist philosophical paradigm that then became a way of seeing reality in medieval Japanese Buddhism, up until more modern period, up until Tokugawa period in the 1600s. So this So the chant we did tonight, which is part of our regular sutta liturgy, you know, is influenced by this. And the way that Dogen talks is influenced by this. All of classic Japanese Buddhism is part of this. And so this was very powerful for Japanese culture and Japanese Buddhism and Japanese aesthetics, too. So I'm going to talk more about that. But there was also a way in which this way of thinking, in which people, beings, could move, could transmigrate between different states in these six realms based on their individual responsibility and actions, people also felt trapped by that. So what developed were ways of relief or escape from this kind of inexorable movement. So LaFleur, he says this is slightly simplified, but he talks about four types of relief or escape from this round of transmigration. And this is very, I think it's very interesting. First, he calls infiltration. So this is devotion. For example, devotion to Kanon, the bodhisattva of compassion, or to Jizo, the earth storehouse bodhisattva. And there were six kanons for the six realms, and that was more in China. We don't have that really from our Japanese heritage. But there were also six Jizo, so this was in Japan, and this is very much in the United States. So in our practice, so often in Japan, you'll see by the roadside six different Jizo figures. Jizo is depicted as a shaved-head monk, and Jizo is important in American Zen practice. Jizo is also considered very much a bodhisattva who helps children and women. And there are services now that are done in American Zen for children who've died and for fetuses after abortion. So Jizo is important in Japan and in American Zen. LaFleur makes the point, though, that in terms of escape from or relief from this round of transmigration, which was the paradigm in Japanese Buddhism, there's two kinds. There's the Buddha who liberates beings from the whole thing. So Buddha, you know, you're liberated from into nirvana, you're liberated from samsara. And then there's the bodhisattvas, like Kanon and Jizo, who help people move up in this six realms, so within these six destinies. So that's interesting. Jizo goes into the hell realms, for example, especially, and helps beings get relieved from there. So that's the first kind. Second kind of the four reliefs is transcendence. So the prime example of this, and there are others, is the Western Paradise, so the Pure Land. So in Japanese Buddhism, this almost becomes a seventh realm. In Pure Land Buddhism in Japan, people chant Namamita Buddha, the Nambutsu chant. They chant to Amida to enter Amida's Western Pure Land after they die. It becomes a better realm. And there's a traditional deathbed practice of chanting Namamita Butsu on your deathbed, and even holding a string connected to a picture of Amida Buddha that will draw you up into the Western Paradise. So that's the second one. The third and fourth are very interesting. The third comes from the Tendai school, which is a basis for Zen and Nichiren Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism in Japan. And LaFleur calls it co-penetration. And it has two parts. The first adds four more realms to the six realms we talked about. The six realms. This is common in Buddhist sutras. So some of you may have heard of this. These four other realms are Shravakas, or students of the Buddha, Pratyeka Buddhas, independent Buddhas who awaken on their own, then Bodhisattvas and Buddhas. So there's 10 altogether, not just the hell realms, hungry ghost realms, animals, humans, asuras, titans, and heavenly realms. But then the second part of this goes back to a great Chinese Buddhist figure named Zhiyi, who lived 538 to 597. There will not be a test. But he's the founder of Qiantai in China, which is the basis for Tendai. And he said, and this is really interesting and really important for us, each of these 10 has all the others in it. So this is a way of seeing Mahayana non-dualism. All the realms include all the other realms. So this was true in all the Japanese Buddhist, in all the later Japanese Buddhist schools. There's a non-separation of the 6 and the 10. They're all, so in some ways, hell being, there are hell beings in the heavenly realms, there are animals in the human realms, there are hungry ghosts in the Asura realms. This is a way of seeing the modern Western perspective on these 6 realms, which is that as human beings, so taking it out of the realm of transmigration, you don't have to literally believe in rebirth, like you might be an animal in the next life, or most Westerners, even Western Buddhists, don't literally believe in rebirth into other realms. But as human beings, some of you may have experienced heavenly realms. Some of you, if you've ever watched television and paid attention to the commercials and thought you had to own all those things in the commercials, you experienced hungry ghost realm. Just never being satisfied. You need more and more and more. So anyway, this idea from this third aspect of relief is this sense of these realms being within each other. So that's pretty interesting, I think. Okay, the fourth realm, which is even more interesting, I think, is the, LaFleur has a kind of religious studies kind of name for it, but basically that these 6 realms are an arena of play. All 6 of them. And we can see this in a lot of the sutras. The Vimalakirti Sutra, for example, where the goddess transforms Shariputra. There are many of the sutras. There's this kind of playfulness with the status of beings as one realm or another. And the Fox Koan's an example in Zen. But this is really important to Japanese aesthetics and art and poetry. There's one example, a little example, is there's a scroll I saw in a temple in Kyoto of animals as monks, and they're dressed in monks' robes. Frogs and monkeys, it's maybe intended to be a satire on the status of the monks, but there's a way in which there's a play with all this stuff, with these different realms. So there's, LaFleur has some interesting quotes about this. This one is from an important Japanese scholar named Kojima, and this is about bodhisattva work as play. So this bodhisattva idea that we talk about here. He says, a bodhisattva is not one who pursues the perfection of wisdom while all the time thinking of his activity as painful austerities. He will never be able to do anything good for sentient beings while having the idea that he is an ascetic. On the contrary, it is only when he begins to enjoy what he is doing that he will be successful. The reason for this is that because there is to be no self whatsoever, even that of the bodhisattva is emptiness. And then LaFleur refers to a quote from the 10 Stages Sutra, which is part of the Flower Ornament, or Kegon Sutra, Keigon in Japanese. So it says, then all the bodhisattva's activities are performed freely, not with the notion that some kind of effort must be expended. This means that his actions are, or her actions are not things she intends in order to realize her own definite goals. They are therefore not conditioned by such attention. This implies that salvation is by easy practice, something equivalent to play. Even compassion is not thought of as compassion, but becomes, so to speak, unconcerned compassion, because in it there is no attachment to goals. This is why the actions of the bodhisattva are empty and pure. So then LaFleur refers to a great modern scholar of Zen, Yanagita, talking about Zen places emphasis upon explanation of transmigration in terms of going right into other species, which is to say, shouldering the karma of earlier lives and going to play in and through the six courses and four modes of being born. The idea is extremely valuable because it collates and connotes at least three things simultaneously. And he goes on anyway. So this is... So this idea, you know, I referred to this yesterday when we were doing, when I was talking about the different realms and going to the different realms and the great master Joshu or Jiaozhou, when he was asked by a monk, well, where are you going to go when you die? And he said, oh, straight to hell. And the monk said, well, why are you going to hell? You're a great master. And he said, well, if I don't, who will welcome you when you go there? So this sense of play with these realms was not only in Zen. So there were lots of forms in all the different Japanese Buddhist forms. There was this sense of play. So, for example, in the Pure Land, there was this dancing Nembutsu, where there were branches of the Pure Land where they would chant Nammida Butsu while they were dancing wildly, you know. And so that was it. That was one of the medieval Pure Land schools. In Shingon, which is the school, the Vajrayana school that Kukai started, there was an understanding of their very, you know, arcane and esoteric rituals as play. They were playing with the forms. And actually, that's important to us because a lot of the forms and ritual forms in Soto Zen come from Shingon. They were adopted by Shingon. So all the forms I did up there when I was offering incense and the way we bow and the way the altar is organized even, all of that comes from Shingon, and it's a kind of play. We're playing with the forms of how we venerate the Buddha. So, anyway, this way of playing with the movement within the six realms is another way of, like, escaping from the kind of rigidity of feeling like you're caught by the six realms. So, this is obviously this sense of transmigrating through these six realms is not how we see reality. But it's part of the background of Japanese Buddhism that is the background of this practice that we're doing. Now, of course, we have to look at this through, I don't know, can we actually play with how we see reality? And what are the paradigms, we have our way of seeing reality in terms of science, in terms of, well, you know, we have to look and see. What is it? How is it that we think reality is constructed? And how can we play with that? And how can we use the forms of awakening practice that we do? So I'll stop. There's a little bit of time for comments, questions, responses. Yes, Jen.
me of this guy saying, well, if I'm not, if it, well, who's going to greet me when you go to hell? For some reason, you know, those two things were juxtaposed. And then I thought about when O.J. was on trial and there was the judge and the prosecutor and the plaintiffs and the respondent, and that children would construct their play. Okay, you're going to be Judge Ito, you're going to be O.J. And they would take the forms of these things that were in the news play around with them. And then the thing that really struck me is the saying that I like is, if you're going through hell, keep going. And and I thought that was appropriate for people who are in the realm of hell, you know, keep going, because there's something beyond it. There's another realm.
Yeah, so that's the way of thinking in this model, that hell is not permanent, that keep going, because if you can be, so Jizo is in the hell realm. The Buddha is in all these realms, or the Bodhisattvas are in all these realms, and they are models of just stay calm. You know, this too will change. other comments or reflections or responses? Ed.
You know, I used to be in Chicago, certainly, you go to a playground, a lot of these types of equipment are no longer there, but you have a choice. You had swings. You had very good grounds. It was always the same choice. Monkey bars,
yeah.
Seesaws. Those are the four top choices. And when you were a kid, you would just throw yourself into the ground and jump from one to the next without any particular rhyme or reason or argument between one versus the other. And that was considered a beauty of playfulness. And I think maybe the association was that we actually had genuine free choice as to which object we would engage. However, at the end of the day, my thinking always was, we're all exactly the same. I'm not sure if I subtract any or I'm not sure if I extract any different emotional experience from the monkey bars as I do from the seesaws. They're just different forms of the same activity. And I think selfishness is a fascinating word because it's ambiguous. I don't know what it refers to, except for what is so obvious as a paradox in our day-to-day behaviors.
Yeah.
And so in your writing and your reading, we discuss separateness as a primary thing that exists in the sixth compartment. But then one transcends from in playfulness. That's a meditation that is worthy of some length.
Yes.
You refer to the aesthetics, Japanese aesthetics, of course we have these two. There are a variety of tapestries on the walls that reflect that awareness.
Yes.
Rather perfectly. So it's a very curious and interesting thing to contemplate.
Yes. Yeah, and I've talked about Zazen as a performance art or a mode of, kind of mode of play, we could say. Rather than some thing that we have to do perfectly. Yes?
How do animals get into like a higher realm, like human realm, you know? Maybe I'm thinking too literally, but I have a lot of squirrels in my yard.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking like, all right, are there good squirrels and bad squirrels? And, like, you know.
There are bad squirrels in my yard.
I know there's bad chipmunks. Because chipmunks are, they're no good.
But maybe there are one or two, you know, better chipmunks. I don't know. Less just, you know, maybe some of the better chipmunks become squirrels and then the better squirrels, yeah, I don't know. That's not how we usually think, right? So it's just because we're doing Zen doesn't mean we have to adapt this worldview, but it's interesting to see that that's in the background of some of what, you know, we study. Yes, hi. Yes.
And how much. But there's a little note on the door that said it was cancelled due to conditions outside of our control.
Ah.
So then I came here.
Well, that's great.
And there's so many really serious things that. And the one book on Chicago, a selection this year is the fifth extinction, the extinction of these birds and animals. It's going to be sad. For me to think that at the end of it all,
well, there is a mass extinction going on, and that doesn't mean that life on Earth will end, but we don't know, and I think we still can, things are going to get bad, and depending on what we do, it will be less bad, maybe. So it doesn't mean that we should just give up, but, you know, we did a well-being service tonight for people in California, and I have been emailing and trying to call friends in Sonoma, where most of the county has been evacuated, and there are I have many Zen teacher friends in Sonoma, and so I don't know how many Zen temples have burned down. So that's just, you know, but all over the planet there are people in facing danger. And people and other beings. It's not just the people who are threatened by the fire. So yeah, it's this serious. So how do we, you know, so I think I take your question is, well, how do we can feel overwhelmed and despairing about this situation, or how do we find a way to play with these horrible realities? I'm tempted to quote that sign I saw down at Trump Towers today. I went down to, you know, greet Mr. Trump on behalf of Chicago, and there was one sign that says, "Trump puts ketchup on his hot dogs." Which is not something you do in Chicago. And there was another sign that says, "All in all," excuse me for this vulgarity, but the sign said, "All in all, you're just another prick with no wall." I don't know. I don't know what we do, you know, that combats it's serious, and how do we find a way to play with this and respond to it, and so I appreciate your question, and I don't have an answer, but I think just feeling overwhelmed and despairing is not a response. And how do we contribute something? You know, what he says about the bodhisattva acting with positive spirits, I think is, you know, another way to say it. I don't know. Any other responses after that?
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, you sure can.
Is it destruction that concerns you?
that there would be